Right, good evening. This is a recording of the class I gave on Monday, but I forgot to record it, so I'm going to record it again, or record it for this time, although there will be no student participation and no chat. So in fact, if I could probably get rid of the chat if I wanted to. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, so what I want to talk about today is basically the history of the English language. Some of what you're going to hear, especially about the origins of English, will not be what you are taught when you do the relevant course. You have to decide whether you agree with me or you agree with them. This should at least be material that should get you thinking. And then you can come to your own conclusions. Right. English is undoubtedly a member of the Germanic language group, because almost all of the 100 most frequently used words in the language are Germanic. This means that English forms part of a cluster of North European languages, which diversified from Proto-Indo-European by making the following sound changes. So, for example, the k sound changed to h, which means that, surprisingly, canine, which is obviously Latinate, is related to the Germanic word hound for a dog. Cornet is related to horn. The d sound changed to t. So duo is related to duo in English. All of the examples I'm giving are all Latinate words in English and Germanic words in English. Obviously, I could go to Romance languages, but I thought it would be better to stick with English since that's what you're learning. So duo is basically the same word as two, but with this Germanic sound change. And we can have both of those changes together. For example, in century and hundred are ultimately the same word, or cardiac and heart. And change number two actually also works in the other way around, so that t sound can change to d with words like mental, which is from Latin, and mind, which is from German. Any type of g sound can change to k, so we have, for example, hostel and guest house. I don't know why that's in that group. Not sure that should be there. Anyway, genus and kin, lagoon and lake. Similar type of thing with horticulture and garden, pyre and fire, piscine and fish. Piscine is an adjective for fish. It doesn't mean piscina. Peril and fear, which come from the change of the p sound to f. And we can have combinations of two and five. Pedal, as the noun for the thing on a bicycle, or pedal as the adjective, both come from the same origin as the word foot, by the same changes. The t sound changes to z, as in maternal and mother, trio and three. Five and six together, we have paternal and father, ultimately the same word. The f sound can change to b, so flower changes to bloom. Fragile, breakable, a combination of the seven and four. Seven and six, we have fraternal and brother. Sometimes these changes can be so bizarre that the different words resulting can be completely unrecognizable. For example, the word haya for the type of tree in Spanish, beach and ultimately book all come from the same origin of fagus in Latin, but by the change F to B, number seven, and the G sound to K sound in number four. So fagus, book, and fagus, haya. Obviously the Spanish tends to change the Latin F sound to an H, quite often to a silent H. Anyway, moving on. Labial, lip, beaker, pitcher as in a jug. vineyard wine, VW, and then with 9 and 2 together, video, which just means I see in Latin, and witness are ultimately the same words, as and then ventilate and wind, 9 and 3. So you should be able to get a very quick idea of the standard changes that form Germanic languages. The other characteristic of Germanic languages, which is very evident from a Spanish point of view, of course, is ablaut, the changing of the vowel sound in the middle and keeping the consonants the same to reflect a change in meaning. Okay. So, when Winston Churchill made his famous speech saying, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender," only the word surrender is not Germanic in origin. And as you can see there, the vast majority of those words are monosyllabic, which is another feature of the Germanic words in English. Surrender, in fact, comes from Anglo-Norman, and no doubt Churchill knew that when he was saying that. In fact, it's possible to write much longer texts using only Germanic words. It was fashionable at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century to write entire novels using basically only Germanic words. A little bit of a silly idea, but anyway. That fashion is often sometimes referred to as Anglish. So if you want to look it up on Wikipedia or something, if you look up Anglish, you'll find examples of that. Right. So Anglish, of course, comes from the word Anglo-Saxon. And the generally agreed history of English goes something like this. In the early 5th century, the Romans left Britain. Shortly afterwards, Angles, Saxons, and Jutes arrived from northern Germany and southern Denmark and pushed the Celtic-speaking native inhabitants into the north and west. The language of the invaders coalesced into Anglo-Saxon, which is also called Old English. After the Norman invasion of 1066, Old English disappeared as a written language, only to reemerge in the 13th century as Middle English. So if we look at the map, we have the Jutes coming from Jutland, the Saxons coming from Saxony, and the Angles coming from Anglin, which is on the border between the two countries, and populating different parts of Romano-Celtic Britain and pushing the poor Celts into the western extremes, the mountainous parts of the country, which the Anglo-Saxons were not interested in. One second. Diga. Sí, ¿qué pasa? No puedo, lo siento. No puedo, estoy en medio de la grabación. Adiós. Sorry about that. The rest of the history of the English language is uncontroversial because Middle English is recognisably the same language as that English speakers use today, and gradually changed over the last seven centuries. The gradual change over the last seven centuries can easily be traced through the written record. You will not find any English teacher, apart from me, or any textbook on the history of English that disagrees with that brief outline. Indeed, referring to Anglo-Saxon as Old English effectively closes any debate about the origins of English. This is absolutely standard and what you will expect to find in any course. However, This assumes that the Anglo-Saxons arrived, exterminated the Romano-British population, occupied their lands, and adopted their farming techniques. There are a number of problems with this idea. There is no archaeological evidence of this massacre. You have to bear in mind that the population of Roman Britain was somewhere between 2.5 million and up to, their estimates are up to 3.5 million. If you have a situation where that number of people are forced out of an area, there should be some sort of archaeological evidence of it. And there is none. The archaeological evidence suggests that only a few thousand Anglo-Saxons came to Britain, in fact. And most of the archaeological evidence suggests much more continuity than some sort of sudden change. For example, the farming techniques continued exactly the same before and after the Romans left. But more importantly, this is simply not what contemporary war bands did. There were 43 invasions of the empire at the end of Roman rule. Visigoths, Ostrogoths, Franks, Sverbs, who else? Vandals, Lombards, etc., etc., etc. And all of the other 42, in all of the other 42 cases, the invaders replaced the Roman elite and set themselves up as the new rulers. Those who worked the land and milked the cows remained doing what they'd always done. That was what the point of the invasion. You wanted to be the new ruling elite. You wanted to be the new Romans. Why would the Anglo-Saxons want to eliminate the people they had come to rule over? Moreover, there's plenty of evidence of the existence of Germanic languages in Britain before the Anglo-Saxon invasion. Even a staunch defender of the conventional theory, like David Crystal, has acknowledged that to me, to my face. There is plenty of evidence that there were Germanic languages in England before the Romans left. Another problem is that Anglo-Saxon is very difficult to date because it hardly changed in the 600 years from 450 to 1050. This is the characteristic of a dead language used for writing rather than of a spoken language, a living language. Indeed, to accept the standard explanation, we have to believe that Anglo-Saxon remained unchanged or practically unchanged for six centuries and then changed almost every word between 1060 and 1200 in a period of less than 150 years. 85% of Old English words disappeared without trace between after the end of the Anglo-Saxon period. Middle English re-emerged, it was structurally completely different. This is simply not how languages work. They don't stay static and then suddenly abruptly change completely. Such a radical change would be unique in the story of linguistics. No other language has ever changed so completely in such a short period of time. Moreover, the standard explanation does not clarify how the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes managed to fuse their distinct languages into one more or less coherent and unified language without the existence of modern standard factors such as compulsory state education or the BBC. If we understand that the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes came over and then set up their separate kingdoms in Wessex, in East Anglia, in Mercia, and in Northumbria, we would expect the languages, given the lack of transport and the separation of these different kingdoms, those languages sort of continued to diverge. The further problem is that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is our main source of information for the time, distinguishes between the Welsh and the British, even though these two people are supposed to be one, according to the traditional history of English. Uh, The story is further complicated by the fact that the Vikings began arriving in Britain and settling in Britain at the end of the, well, they first arrived at the end of the 8th century and began to settle in the 9th century. However, Anglo-Saxon adopted hardly any Viking words. There are something like 25 Viking words that were adopted by Anglo-Saxon. However, once the Vikings had disappeared from history, and they had been incorporated into the general population, we have thousands of Norse words in Middle English, thousands of words that the Vikings would have been speaking. So why did Old English resist adopting Norse words for 250 words of coexistence, and then once the Vikings had disappeared, adopt hundreds of terms? The only way of explaining this is if there is some type of spoken language which is different from written Anglo-Saxon. All this is also somewhat surprising, given that Anglo-Saxon did adopt some 450 words from Latin. And in fact, that's one of the ways that we date it. So the probable answer to all these questions comes from distinguishing written language from demotic language. It is quite common for a ruling elite to speak and write in a language that is distinct from that of the majority underclass. That is what happened in the Roman Empire. The Roman elite was speaking in Latin, or certainly writing all their written records in Latin and their poetry in Latin, while the rest of the population carried on speaking whatever they had been speaking. Nobody suggests that the native population of English of England were speaking Latin throughout the Roman occupation. We know that that is what happened after the Norman invasion of England. The Norman elite, about 8% of the population, were speaking Norman French and what became Anglo-Norman, and the rest of the population must have been speaking something different, must have been speaking English. Similarly, in the British Empire, you have the colonial elite and people writing using their using English, and the rest of the population continuing in their own languages. If you were to use only the written record, you would have the impression that in the 18th and 19th century, people in India basically stopped speaking Urdu and Hindi and all of the other local languages and only spoke English, because the vast majority of what was written in the 18th and 19th century until 1949 in India was written in English. But that, of course, is not the case. So Anglo-Saxon was probably just a written language used for ceremonious things such as writing chronicles and poetry. Meanwhile, the population spoke English, which evolved throughout the period. Controversially, English probably existed in Britain from the end of the last ice age and throughout the Celtic and Roman periods. We have to bear in mind that the area where Proto-Germanic first appeared was actually connected to England by a land bridge. Until about 5000 BC, well before the Romans, of course, there was some sort of land bridge between Britain and the continent. There's still an area of shallow land known as Dogger Bank in the North Sea, which reflects the remains of what was this land bridge. In the millennia after that, we know that there was continuous contact between the Germanic-speaking populations in the North Sea, which was basically a Germanic sea, and people moving to and fro between England and northern Germany and Denmark and Scandinavia. In fact, genetic evidence in recent years suggests that pre-Roman Britain was colonized by two distinct groups. So you had what are described as Celtic tribes, Ibero-Celts, colonizing Brittany and France, and Cornwall and Wales and Cumbria and Ireland. And you have Germanic groups colonizing what is effectively England minus the West Country. And that, of course, reflects what we know that people spoke in the historical period. We know that people in Ireland were speaking a Celtic language, Brythonic, and Cornish survived until the 18th century in Cornwall, and Welsh still exists in Wales, and Cumbric still existed until the 11th century in Cumbria, and Scots Gaelic still exists just in the Highlands and the Islands of Scotland in this area. So what that would suggest is that people have basically continued to speak the same languages in the same areas, with a move in the frontier between those two areas as English came to dominate the entire archipelago in the late medieval and modern period. So we understand that we have Brythonic speaking people on the east coast of the country and Germanic speaking people on the west coast of the country, with the north of England dominated by people who speak languages related to Norse, and the south with languages more related to Saxon and Anglian. Is what is reflected later by the areas that the Vikings choose to settle. The Vikings settle an area of land where people speak practically the same language as themselves, and they are resisted and kept out of the part of England where the language has some significant difference. Now, one of the arguments for the idea that the majority of the population were speaking Brythonic throughout, speaking the Celtic language of Brythonic throughout the country during the Roman occupation and before it, is that we have some place names and tribal names that may be from Brythonic in the east of the country, and we have elements of Celtic culture. Well, the first thing to comment is that cultural elements like farming techniques do not reflect language. You can easily pick up a farming technique or a way of making a ceramic object, etc., etc., without choosing to adopt somebody's language. But even if we did have a situation where some of the ruling class in the English area before and during the Roman invasion were Brythonic speakers, that doesn't necessarily reflect, as we've seen, what the majority of the population were speaking. You can have a situation where most people are speaking English, as we will begin to call it, in this area, even if some of the ruling elites may have been warlords who had come over from the Celtic areas during the Celtic occupation. Just as nobody believes that everybody in Britain spoke Latin during the Roman occupation, why should everybody have spoken Brythonic during the Celtic occupation, if there was one? From this perspective, Demotic English gradually adopted hundreds of words from its sister languages, Anglo-Saxon and Norse, while conservative Anglo-Saxon, written Anglo-Saxon, did not. The number of modern English words that are undeniably drawn from Anglo-Saxon, such as bird or woman or lord, lady, and sheriff, is laughably small. Incidentally, a problem for both the conventional theory and the Demotic English theory that I am presenting today is that there are so few Brythonic words in English, apart from place names. There are basically half a dozen, and only two or three which are at all well known. Probably the only important word, the only word you will ever come across in English which has a Brythonic origin, is crag. The word crag for a stony top of a mountain. We just don't. There is just no serious adoption of Brythonic words into English, and it's very difficult to explain this under any scenario. If English and Brythonic languages have coexisted in England or in Albion, whatever you want to call it, in Britain, for since the late Stone Age, since the Neolithic, you would expect there to be some transfusion of words and structures. If they have existed since sometime before the Roman period and during the entire Roman period, you would expect the same. It's very difficult to explain. By comparison, English has many more terms from, for example, Turkish, despite there being no continuous contact with Anatolia. But we've adopted dozens of words from Turkish, as we have from most languages in the world, but the exception is Brythonic, and nobody can really explain that. So, as I mentioned, the Vikings began to colonize the country, the north of the country, in the 9th century. Conventional linguistic history says that Norse, Northern Germanic, arrived in England in the 9th century with the Viking occupation of Northern England. Modern English contains some 800 words that come from Old Norse. Middle English actually adopted thousands of Norse words. Yet only about 25 of these words, as I said, were assimilated during the Anglo-Saxon period. So that necessarily implies that Norse had a significant impact on Demotic English, and significant it means that even the conventional theory has to accept the existence of Demotic English underneath, hidden by Anglo-Saxon, if you like. The adoption of the Norse words was relatively unproblematic since both languages were Germanic, so you will have English words like ersen and a Norse word like horsa, and they both and either one could be the origin of our word horse, and be and obviously they would be relatively easy to understand between them. In fact, a number of Germanic words were adopted twice into English. Once into from Anglo-Saxon or Demotic English, and the other time from Norse, and they are obviously cognates. So shatter and scatter are cognates. Shirt and skirt are cognates. Shriek and screech are cognates. Shrub, meaning undergrowth, plants and things, and scrub, meaning the same thing, are cognates. A ship is captained by the skipper of the ship. Skipper is a Norse word. Ship is a Western Germanic word, a word from Anglo-Saxon or Demotic English. Even shell and skull we can include in those groups. Sorry, those pairs. So a more radical view would be that the thousands of Norse words in Middle English have been part of Demotic English from the beginning, from the earliest German Germanic settlements of England. Stephen Oppenheimer's The Origins of the British demonstrates genetically that English has been receiving, sorry, England has been receiving Scandinavian immigrants since the Neolithic. So the Old Norse words and structures could have been a central part of Proto-English spoken before the Romans arrived. Moreover, there are literally thousands of words in modern English that could come from either Anglo-Saxon or Old Norse. Words like knife or sell or send or sit, there is a they are structurally they are as close to Old Norse as they are to Anglo-Saxon. conventionally, these words are ascribed automatically to Old English because it is considered more central to the history of English having arrived earlier. In fact, the words that are accepted as coming from Norse are simply those that cannot be ascribed to Anglo-Saxon. However, if one accepts the existence of demotic Germanic language in England before the Anglo-Saxons arrive, the field is wide open, and the Germanic words in English could be primarily North Germanic rather than West Germanic, could be primarily related to what was being spoken in Scandinavia rather than what was being spoken on the German-Danish border. In any event, medieval English, called conventionally Middle English, emerged in the 13th century with a Germanic grammatical base, but with an important infusion of words from French, Latin, and Norse. Latin was particularly influential on religious language for obvious reasons. Over half of the everyday words in modern English come from French. Indeed, French words were often adopted twice, first from Norman French and then from Francien, which is standard French. So as we did with the Germanic words, we can do the same sort of thing with French words. The words on the left come from Norman French, which is a sort of rustic form of French that was spoken in Normandy, and the words on the right are related to standard French. So warden, guard, or guardian, warranty and guarantee. In fact, warranty and guarantee are largely used interchangeably in modern English. Reward and regard, the meanings have diverged, but their origin is the same. Wise and guise. Guise is appearance, basically. Wily, meaning something like astute, and guile, astuteness, astuthia, are related. Cattle, a word that means cows, is related to chattel, a word that means property. Like the Maasai in Africa, there was a time where your property was measured in the number of cows that you owned in England. Catch and chase were originally the same word. Car and chariot. Pocket and pouch. Pouch is a type of bag. Again, you can see that there are standard changes between those two varieties, meaning that we have adopted them twice. So French tended to influence the vocabulary of the elite, while the English and Norse lexicon was used for everyday language. As a result, a basic dichotomy emerged in English between Latinate terms used for abstractions versus Germanic terms used for more concrete concepts. This is often illustrated in terms used for animals, cared for by the English-speaking peasantry, and meat eaten by the French-speaking elite. Don't know if I have this one. Did I make a slide move? No, I didn't. Go back. So, the animal is called a sheep, and the animals are called sheep, but the meat is traditionally called mutton, which of course is related to mouton in French. The animal is called a cow, but the meat is called beef, from bœuf in French. The animal is called a pig, but the meat is called pork. And you can think of porcine and other words which have a Latinate origin. The living animal, like Bambi, is called a deer, but the dead animal is called venison, again coming from French. So you can see there the different uses of the different forms of the language. This abstract concrete dichotomy is why, even today, as Spanish speakers, you often find academic texts easier to understand, say, than sensationalist newspapers or everyday speech, because erudition uses primarily Latinate vocabulary. Incidentally, the mixture of languages that made up medieval English explains why the three major inflections in English all involve adding an S. From the Northern Demotic English came the idea of standardizing the plural forms of nouns by simply adding S. So we talk about three books. Now that is also something that happens in Spanish, so you may think that that is just normal or just the way things are. But of course, that is not what happens in French often. It's not what happens in German. It's not what happens in Italian. It is one of these bizarre things that happens in English and Spanish, and it's not quite clear why. From Southern English came the Saxon genitive, the genitive formed by adding apostrophe S. That apostrophe S was originally, in fact, ES. The E was eliminated as a separate syllable, and so we put the apostrophe in to mark where the E was. So we can say three books, or the books cover. Finally, Norse gave English the standard form of adding S to the third person singular of a verb in the present. She books, reserves a foreign holiday once a year. So we have books as a plural for a noun, books as the third person singular form of the verb, and books as a plural for the noun, books as a genitive marker with the apostrophe, or books as the third person singular of the verb. Bizarre that English should use exactly the same suffix for the three major inflections, but that is just an accident of history. Not too far. In the 14th century, English nationalism needed to be fortified in the Hundred Years' War against the French. So first Parliament and then the King adopted English as their official language. As a result, English became both the official language and the language of the majority. By the way, over 90% of the population spoke English throughout the medieval period. The number of people who were speaking French of any sort was never more than 10% of the population. So, by the beginning of the 17th century, English had largely been standardized, as reflected in the authorized version of the King James Bible, as you can see there, and the complete works of William Shakespeare, which you may have heard of. From this point of view, our story is largely one of world domination from this point forward. The fundamentals of the language do not change, though English is open to foreign terms, so the vocabulary expanded exponentially as words were freely borrowed from languages around the world to describe new concepts. And in this story of world domination, of English conquering the world, as it were, we have a very big enigma. In 1600, nobody would have bet on English becoming a global language. At that time, English was only spoken by 2 million people. English didn't have a single successful colony outside the British Isles, and even Ireland was far from secure. In fact, there were even places on the island of Britain where most people didn't speak English still, like large parts of Highlands of Scotland, in Cornwall and places like that, and of course in Wales. People would have imagined that Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, Italian, Urdu, Mandarin, Chinese or French would have had a better chance of dominating the world in 1400 than English. And this was something that was quite clear to contemporaries. Oliver Cromwell conducted his diplomacy in Latin, and Newton wrote his Principia in 1887 in Latin as well, because you could hardly expect foreigners to learn English. So we have to ask ourselves, how did this second division language become the second language of choice in almost every country in the world? A language spoken to some degree or other by an estimated 2 billion people. Well, one piece of the jigsaw was demographic. The population of England doubled between the mid-16th and the mid-17th century to over 5 million. However, at the same time, enclosures, engrossing and other changes meant that there were progressively fewer opportunities for the poor, especially in the countryside, and the poor were encouraged to emigrate. Meanwhile, criminals were transported to the colonies from the mid-16th to the mid-19th century. And to be transported, you only had to have committed the most ridiculously minor of crimes for that to be a justification for the authorities to transport you if they felt that you were appropriate material, if you were young, etc. Oops, too far. Ironically, however, the most significant event in the 17th century for the English language was the ascension of Dutchman William of Orange to the throne of England, this man. William III brought with him the sophisticated banking practices first developed in Holland. One result was the Bank of England, which was able to borrow enormous sums of the enormous sums necessary for Britain to build fleets that could dominate the world. Basically, the expansion of European civilization around the world at this time is based a little bit on the Spanish model of countries borrowing money, nation states borrowing money to pay for armies, which would then conquer territory and use what they were able to plunder and what they were able to generate from the territories that they had occupied to pay the banks back. And this was a process which first involved the kings and queens of Castile and the Genovese banks. But it was a process that became more and more expensive, and Britain was better at playing this game, basically, than the French were. More than anything else, it was the modern financial system based in London that led to the eventual British triumph over France internationally. The most significant linguistic event in the history of English of the 18th century was Samuel Johnson, this guy's Dictionary of the English Language of 1755, which further helped to standardize English. And Samuel Johnson is my justification for giving you this talk about the history of English, because there is a letter about his dictionary on page 55 and 56 of your course book. So that's why I'm actually talking about this. However, there was a military event which was much more important in the long term for English, which began the year after Johnson published his dictionary, began in 1756. And this was the First World War. Confusingly, this global conflict wasn't called the First World War. First World War happened at the beginning of the 20th century. It was called the Seven Years' War. But in fact, it was much more of a world war than the Great War, World War I, the First World War, as it is known, in that it happened literally, affected countries all around the world, whereas most of the fighting in the First World War in the 20th century was in Europe and the Middle East. Anyway, what happened in that conflict between Britain and its allies and France and its allies is relatively unimportant. What is important is that by the end of the conflict, Britain had driven France out of North America and out of India. This guaranteed that the United States and Canada, except for Quebec, would be English speaking, and basically, it meant that English had its first continent. The first continent where it was the dominant language, because of course Spain sold Florida Spain sold Florida directly to the United States. So shortly after this conflict, it didn't actually help Britain that much, because shortly afterwards America became independent, but of course it became independent as an English-speaking country. And then the French sold the Louisiana Territory to the United States, and the United States began to occupy the whole of the continent. India was an even more bizarre situation, in that it was governed by a private corporation, by the East India Company. By the early 19th century, the East India Company controlled half of the world's trade, and by the mid-century, a fifth of the world's population was under its trading influence. As a multinational, it's a very strange historical quirk. So, While accumulating unimagined wealth from, among other things, slavery and opium trafficking, Britain became the first industrial nation. The reasons for this are complex, but the country was clearly in a privileged position geographically and geologically. On the one hand, as an island, Britain was not subject to the threat of invasions in the same way as other European nations were. Moreover, Britain had valuable natural resources, especially coal, iron, tin, copper, and graphite. Ironically, when Napoleon blockaded British access to European markets, it forced Britain to further expand its trade around the world. The 19th century saw what has been called the scramble for Africa, in which the European powers competed to occupy enormous expanses of the African continent. The process culminated in the 1885 Berlin Conference. On paper, France was the great winner of this conference, in that it acquired the most land, and especially the most continuous land. As you can see, France occupied an enormous area of northwestern Africa. However, this was actually the result of quite clever negotiating by the British. The British government basically ceded to France control over the Sahara Desert, which is most of this area, while getting control of the most populous areas of West Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, which was called the Gold Coast at the time, and Sierra Leone, and having an almost continuous run of countries, especially the hugely rich countries like South Africa, Botswana and Zimbabwe, called Rhodesia at the time, down the eastern side of Africa. But there was a problem with this, because the British government had to explain to the opposition and explain to the British public that they had been clever enough just to get the French to accept a desert, while they got some economically interesting countries, and also countries which were very important in protecting the route to India, which was that the British Empire was always about India. So having control of a land route here, which eventually became the Suez Canal, had become the Suez Canal by this stage, and a route around Africa, and control of the sea around here as well, in British Somaliland, meant that Britain was able to defend its connection with Africa, which was what was most important. So what the British government said in Parliament was that the French territory was rather light soil, and the British, the opposition and the British public were able to understand this coded message that basically the French had got sand, had got desert, whereas the French press reporting on the British parliamentary proceedings did not notice, and so this was not reported back to France and didn't become an international problem, and the French signed this agreement. So a bit of clever linguistics there. Okay, as a result of all this, by the end of the First World War, Britain was in control of a quarter of the world's land and 458 million people, nearly 25% of the human population at the time, were living in the British Empire. While the British Empire rapidly disintegrated after the First World War, it morphed into the Commonwealth, an organization with a combined population of 2.1 billion people, 30% of humanity, which in practice promotes English-speaking culture. This is the British Empire between 1918 and 1939, between the wars. And of course, that does not include the English-speaking United States, and in fact, at the time, the United States was also occupying the Philippines and Cuba, but we won't talk about that. The red area, if it's for English rather than British domination, would be even bigger. However, what really secured the place of English was that the British Empire was superseded by US hegemony. Previously, superpowers such as Spain, the Ottomans, or France had been replaced by empires that spoke a different language, reducing the impact of their hegemony. Oops. However, in the period from 1760 to 2020, there was a process of continuous English-speaking globalization. That's over 250 years, over a quarter of a millennium. And of course, while that was going on, this period coincided with the globalization of communications from the telegraph to the telephone to the internet. As a result, when the world globalized, it did so in English. This is why English hegemony occurs on so many different levels. Science, engineering, sports, entertainment, higher education, journalism, the internet, music, and culture are all dominated by English to a greater or lesser extent around the world. Four of the six countries with most soft power, that's non-violent influence, in the world are English-speaking, according to international measures. The breadth and depth of English expansion means that English has critical mass. No other language seriously challenges the role of English, so more and more people learn English. 350 million Chinese are now learning English. That's more than the population of the United States. China and India use English to expand economically around the world. The internal language of Siemens and Deutsche Bank and other German multinationals is English. So Germans in Spain write to Germans in Germany in English within those companies. Meanwhile, Chinese corporations hire amateur native English speaking actors to pretend to be members of their executives to boost the corporation's kudos. It looks good if you have somebody who is an Anglo on your board and who can speak English, even if they're not actually part of the company. Even in a continent with only one English-speaking country, like South America, Chile plans to be bilingual in English by 2030. The same is true of Mongolia. Similarly, English is the working language of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which covers basically all of this area. Despite the fact that ASEAN does not contain a single English-speaking country. Critical mass also means that even though the UK has left the EU, 94% of European secondary school students are learning English, and that isn't going to change. In recent years, Rwanda, Algeria, and Vietnam have abandoned their colonial language, French, for English. Within a couple of decades, it is predicted that English will become the lingua franca of Africa. The Goethe Institute, whose job is to promote German culture, now promotes German culture through English, while international state channels from France and Russia are also in English. This is the current situation in schools around the world. The burgundy colour is native English speakers, and that, of course, is what we would tend to refer to as the Anglosphere, Britain, Ireland, Canada, United States. And there is the cow. Australia and New Zealand. But in the countries which are coloured red, all students are learning English. So we've talked about Chile, but large parts of Latin America, all students are learning English. Most of Africa, most of Europe, the vast majority of Asia, which is where the population of the world, most of the population of the world actually lives, are learning English. Most students, that's where all students are learning English, most students learn English in the rest of Europe, in Russia, in the most of the rest of Africa, the remaining part of Africa. And even in those countries where most students don't learn English, some do. So if in some of these cases, it may be 45% of students who are learning English. And that, again, means that English is not going to decline in the near future. English now grows in periods of expansion, carried forward by globalization, and during recessions. With increased competition for jobs, who can afford to ignore English? Meanwhile, the mass media and the internet mean that the main varieties of English are converging. British and American and Australian English, for example, are more and more similar. They're not more and more different. Over the last 20, 30 years, they have begun to converge again. The rise of English shows that predicting the relative importance of a language in the long term is a fool's game. However, it is inconceivable that English could lose its dominant global position within our lifetimes. And ultimately, that's all that we're really concerned about, isn't it? Okay, well, that is it. I hope you have enjoyed this talk, which has lasted almost exactly 1 hour. And next week, I will be talking about wordplay in English. Bye-bye.